The Big Weekend of Books
on Radio National.
I'm Jonathan Green, normally presenter of Radio National's Blueprint for Living. For the Big Weekend of Books, I had the great pleasure of meeting that doyen of landscape, travel, nature writing, Robert McFarlane, and his illustrator, companion and co-creator, Jackie Morris. Robert McFarlane is a professional peregrinator, a climber, a walker, an author. Mountains of the Mind, The Wild Places, The Old Ways, Landmarks, so many more. And now with Jackie Morris, The Lost Words and The Lost Spells. He's an explorer in words and in deeds. Jackie Morris, according to her publisher's biography, once dreamt of becoming an artist and living by the sea. She is now an artist living by the sea. She's therefore the stuff of dreams. She's a children's author and artist. She's created over 40 books and collaborated with the likes of Ted Hughes and now Robert McFarlane. Robert, Jackie, welcome to Radio National's Big Weekend of Books.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks very much.
It's lovely to be in Australia.
Well, yeah. by the magic of the internet, here you are. This is a wonderful collaboration between the two of you. I mean, what's the secret sauce of it? It's become quite a fecund association. Jackie, would you like to start with that? How did you two meet?
We met by a polar bear in London outside the Shell building.
Excuse me?
A 12-foot polar bear. A 20-foot polar bear.
It was massive, and it was a protest from Greenpeace against oil exploration by Shell. It seemed to be the best place for a McFarlane and a Morris to meet. And then we moved on from there, having had a chat with the guys who were sleeping in this polar bear. And I said to Rob, right, we'd better go now. And he said, yes, which way is it? And I thought, hang on a minute.
There's a question.
I thought you were the guy who knew where you were going.
Mr. Maps. My GPS doesn't work in cities, Jackie. You know that now.
Yeah, well, I know now, but I didn't know then. But before that, we'd met online, and I had got in touch with Rob about an idea that had formed in my mind about creating a book. It had come to light through various ways that very common knowledge and naming for wild things in the UK was slipping out of the mouths and the minds of children, mostly because I guess their parents weren't teaching them. And I wanted to try and find a way to just celebrate these words and hopefully bring them back into classrooms. And I never imagined when I sent this email to Rob, to which he replied, thank you for your email. I'm very busy at the moment. I've got it pinned to the wall, Rob, next to the Greenaway certificate. So I do go back to it occasionally. It was lovely because the thing about Rob is he almost writes emails like people write letters. And it's always a joy receiving one, especially when there are some words for me to illustrate attached to them. Yeah, well, our kind of working relationship and friendship, Rob?
Deep friendship, as far as I'm concerned. You might feel otherwise, Jackie.
Yeah. Well, I love the way, you know, I'm described as the stuff of dreams, or in Rob's case, nightmares.
Well, Robert, let me get your side of the story here. I mean, that notion of Jackie's, and this is full of riches, this idea of lost words and what that might mean for that association with the natural world. How did that strike you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I should probably name some of the names, really. So the first book we made together, The Lost Words, which is a huge book in size. It's sort of foot and a half tall and big enough for a child to crawl inside. I remember giving it to someone before it had been published, and they said, this isn't a book, it's a place. And I thought, what a wonderful phrase.
That is nice.
Something that spoke of what the risk that had been taken with the book. But so Acorn, Bramble, Conker, all the way through Kingfisher, Otter, Willow, and Wren, our tiniest and or one of our tiniest and our most populous bird in this country. So we just took 20 of these everyday nature words, the creatures and the plants that we live with in this country, in our cities as well as in rural contexts. And for each one, I wrote a spell, a poem, an acrostic, which spelled out in both the magical and the simple sense the name. And Jackie then painted these extraordinary accompanying images. First, the absence of the word, then the icon of the word set on gold, because Jackie draws in these extraordinary influences and echoes from many traditions, including sort of Russian Orthodox icons almost. And then the return of the thing to its full landscape, its full ecology. I could read one if you like, if that's a way to...
That's entirely appropriate.
So this, actually, I've chosen Bramble, which I wrote in 2016. So Bramble's our briar. It gives us our blackberries. Have you got brambles there, or?
I think we will have associations springing into our mind as you.
Yeah.
They're probably noxious in this country, but never mind.
Well, they're like the sort of barbed wire of plants. They loop and they curl and yet they give this extraordinary fruit gift every autumn, and so they also make habitat for many, many creatures that dwell within their protection. But I wrote this spell in 2016, and it's become, the reason I chose it is because it's become a sort of lockdown spell. You'll hear that it's really about the emptying out of cities. And well, here goes with its uncanny echoes 5 years later. Bramble. Bramble is on the march again, rolling and arching along the hedges into parks on the city edges. All streets are suddenly thick with briar. Cars snarled fast, business over. Moths have come in their millions, drawn to the thorns. The air flutters. Bramble has reached each house now, looped it in wire. People lock doors, close shutters. Little shoots steal through keyholes to leave in quiet halls, empty stairwells, bowls of bright blackberries, where the light falls. It's a slightly unrepresentative spell because it's somber and sort of strange and dystopian, or at least sort of predictive. But each stanza begins B-R-A-M-B-L-E to fulfill the acrostic spell. And it's partly, I think so many people have found that just everyday near at hand nature has been an anchor point in this time. And I know you guys are deep in a series of rolling lockdowns right now, and emptied cities, and you look nearby.
It's perhaps the positive of that experience to see that immediate world with new eyes. Jackie, when you read those words and words like them and then begin that process of imagining, how does that sit? How can you walk us through that sort of internal framing and dialogue?
I carry the words in my mind, and I've always, when I read, I see images. When I read a story, it plays a film in my head. And often with these, they would come with instructions as to when to read them. The moth one, Rob said, go out in the twilight and read it, and Curlew was take it to the hill. So I would print them out, put them in my pocket, take them for a walk. Bramble is a fantastic excuse for not doing any gardening. So outside my back door, there is the most wonderful kind of Sleeping Beauty-like wall of brambles, which are just coming into fruit at the moment. And I was lucky enough this year to see bullfinches in there right by the back door. It's just fantastic. Love it. So, but what I loved about this whole book was the closeness of everything. So I did a book called The Snow Leopard, and would have been great if the publisher's budget had given me time to go to the Himalayas and
It's such a wonderful book.
Snow Leopard. Thank you. It's. I did actually go to a place called Welling Garden City where a woman had 17 leopards in her back garden. So I did see snow leopards.
And there hangs a tail.
Yeah, it's a quite a good one.
17 tails.
They were amazing, her snow leopards. She was like a cat rescue place, and all the creatures there were very, very well looked
except
after.
Except for leopards.
So I did drawing from life. But with this, you know, I stepped out of the front door and there's the dandelion growing right out in where it shouldn't be, but actually for me where it should be, and brambles very close. But what I really loved about this was I thought I knew what a bramble looked like, but until you start painting something, until you really look at it, until you translate the shape of it into pencil line and then paint, you don't see it in the same way. When you look really closely at a dandelion head with all those beautiful soft seeds, and you're translating that into painting, that's when you really see it for the first time. So it was an eye-opening experience for me working on this book. And also, I have to say it, I suppose, you know, the language in the book is beautiful.
what a freely given compliment, Jackie. Yes.
Yeah.
So some might see that, Robert, as faint praise, but I
well, let me give a full-throated reply. You know, I see Jackie, anyone who hasn't seen these illustrations, you know, you meet them in the book, really, but you can see them online. Those blackberries are so bright that, you know, birds would come to peck at them. You just want to eat them off the page. And I think Jackie is in a great historical lineage, predominantly male, of natural historical illustrators. And we were together in the Natural History Museum not so long ago, deep in the archives, and we were looking at the work of, indeed, you know, things like the Banks Voyage. And of course, it's, you know, there's a deep ingrained colonial history here, first seeings, gatherings, taxonomies, and so forth, and ownings, and all these problematic traditions, but at the heart are makers and painters whose job it was before photography to see these things and to carry them back as images. Jackie's work is fully free of the problems, but persists with the kind of brilliance. And it was very moving to me to be there and to realize that Jackie was of kin with, you know, some of these great 19th, 18th century illustrators. So she is a magician, and she lives in a magic place. And the first time I ever heard of her was a friend who'd met her on a windy headland in Wales, who said, I came around this corner and I found a sorcerer leading two leopards for a walk with a staff in her hand and her hair blowing wild. And that was Jackie Morris. But anyway, we should move on. Yes.
Well, I wanted to pick up on the point, Robert, that Jackie made about, you know, when she is at that point of having to address a subject with the view of rendering it, of painting it, of seeing it anew. I mean, is it a similar thing in the writing as well? I mean, and I wonder too, and you've written so much about the natural world, I mean, how much the realization of that, it is poetic, and you're writing poetry in these books, in The Lost Words, The Lost Spells, but I wonder if there is a broader poetry in writing about nature, that it requires poetry to describe the hidden spaces in the natural world, to describe the things that are evoked by the natural world, not simply describe the physical presence. I mean, that's poetic.
Yeah. Well, there's lots in that very rich question. There's a kind of metaphysics of presence, I suppose, implied, which we might set aside here. But I the oldest poetry in this island group of ours about nature is early Celtic Christian poetry. Some of it, you know, jottings by copyist monks on remote westerly headlands, not unlike the one that Jackie now lives on. The tradition of quote unquote nature writing in this country is, you know, goes all the way back to the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries. And so just to amateurishly be part of a tradition like that. I think increasingly in song, I suppose, I try to write songs, songs of celebration, praise songs, blessings. I could read you Jay, which is very short. You have Jays in that country, Corvids? They kind of sound like this, a little bit like magpies. They have this beautiful pink plumage and a blue, bright blue wing stripe or wing patch. And what one of the many things about them is that they plant trees. They are one of the great tree planting forces in this country. They make squirrels look like amateurs. A jay can cache 4,000 to 8,000 acorns in a season. Recent work on Cambridgeshire woodlands that were naturally reforesting, i.e. rather than being planted in planters and tubes, showed that jays were responsible for about half of that reforestation work. So I kind of took that notion that the jay was a forest maker, and I wrote this call and answer song, and it goes like this. It's since been set beautifully to music by Sekou Keita, the Senegalese kora player, and the rest of the Spell Songs musicians. Here we go. Jay, jay, plant me an acorn. I will plant you 1,000 acorns. Acorn, acorn, grow me an oak. I will grow you an oak that will live for 1,000 years. Year, year, fledge me a jay. I will fledge you a jay that will plant you 1,000 acorns that will each grow 1,000 oaks, that will each live 1,000 years, that will each fledge a bright-backed, blue-winged, forest-making jay. And that's it, really. I like to think that simple praise song of the forest maker has some very, very remote kinship with some of the oldest praise songs in this country.
Are you touched, Jackie, by that deep past in these things and this way of realizing the natural world? I mean, there's such a history here.
I am. I mean, one of the things that I love is the old medieval manuscripts, which there is no artist's name to most of them. They're anonymous and their work stands through the years. There's a beautiful book called The Sherborne Missal, which is bigger than The Lost Words, I think, and a lot more pages. I did actually send a link to our publisher going, look, we could do this.
I've got the vellum.
Yeah.
It's not very environmentally friendly vellum, I think, at large.
But it's the beauty of the observation of the birds, the person who painted the birds, which are just marginalia, obviously looked at them, and the old names. What I love about Robert's words is when you live with them for long enough to paint them and send them in a different direction, they have claws. And I, who can remember nothing, can remember these. And they live inside me and they kind of become part of my bones. So I can just recite an otter whenever I need to. And I have loved seeing children doing the same thing, learning them, not by rote. The children are actually choosing themselves to learn these words, and they're singing them out like praise songs. What the one school said, their parents were getting in touch and saying, what is this? My child just keeps talking about jackdaws and coming out with these rap lines about jackdaws. And then they got their parents learning them. And this is the way to educate, I think, is to get your children to carry the education back to the adults. Mm.
There's something, though, isn't there, Robert, bittersweet in that? And that sudden appreciation by young people of a world that is quite quickly vanishing.
Yeah, I mean, we should pull it to the urgent present, I suppose. And Britain is a drastically defaunated island group. We have many species on the red list, effectively. So at serious risk of population decline and subsequent extirpation within the within this landscape. And many of the creatures and indeed the plants in that we name and celebrate are slipping away, starling and swift and curlew perhaps above all. Some of them are bouncing back. Goldfinch is a wonderful example of a bird that makes a comeback and reminds us that given the chance, nature will return, life will pour back. But the book is, you know, it's taken us by surprise. It's become so many things. It's a shapeshifter itself. It's a card game, a stage show, an album, a dance performance.
I'm sure you're working on socks.
Good idea. We haven't branded socks yet. No, but above all, it's found its way into schools and homes and hearts, and it at very large scale. And that, I think, you know, growing an everyday nature literacy, as Jackie says, from the children up, as it were, is it's a really hard thing to do. This is only a small part of it, but it's kind of crucial work. We stand, on with our toes over the brink of a very steep precipice, and sometimes it can feel absolutely hopeless. But
it's a precipice created to some extent by the abstraction of that natural world, by the fact that so many of us have no association with it. So to learn these words, to read these spells, to see those images.
Well, a small step. I'm always very careful. We're always very careful. You know, it's not the children's fault. You know, it's very hard to locate fault here for that growing away. We're all part of it. And as for the kind of abstraction and reification of nature, well, that, you know, that goes back to an expansion of 14th century capitalism that makes everything fungible, turns everything into resource. And, you know, we live with the benefits, some of us, and the consequences, many of us, of that long historical work of capitalism, which is a kind of xenobiont, a wild creaturely system in its own right. And it's very hard to fight against. So this is our, what Jackie once memorably called our beautiful protest. The beauty is hers, her painting, really. That it was an attempt to use beauty to protest. I guess that's what I mean, rather than the self-congratulatory implication that we had made something beautiful. That was the aspiration.
In that beauty, Jackie, and I think this is an interesting thing in a person capturing the wild. I mean, as you say, the birds have claws, the foxes do have teeth. Yeah. This is a world which is a bloody and ruthless one that these little people live in. Are there risks for the illustrator in bringing too much love to that project, in seeing these creatures with too much sort of human affection?
I kind of don't think I do, really. I tend to loathe anthropomorphication whilst at the same time wishing to become a fox. So it's a curious balance to walk. But I think there's a lot more honesty about animals. And, you know, I know a fox will go into a hen coop and kill everything. But I feel very much that... we need to start addressing the rights of life, be that a tree or a plant or an animal. There seems to be a habit in the UK at the moment of pollarding trees to the point where you have these limbless trunks sticking up so that the birds don't, poo on people's cars and things like that. There's one side of the population who adore trees, and there's another side who want to cut them down so that they don't cause insurance claims or a slight bend in the pavement where a root comes up. I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this, actually. I think I'm starting to get angry now.
Yeah. Tell me why angry. That response comes from where in this?
I love the shape of trees, and I find it quite astonishing that people can cut down a mature tree sometimes without any kind of permission, and then their apology is to plant 10 saplings. And the lack of understanding of the life that has been taken, the very rich life that has been taken, usually for the practice of commerce in some way, is shows such a dearth, such a poverty of spirit, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned, Robert, just before, a 1,000-year-old oak. That the possibility of creatures with that span, with us just weaving among them, it's requires a sort of a reversal of priority and a reversal of an investment of respect on the part of humans to sort of see this world perhaps more properly for what it is.
Yeah. I mean, this is obviously hard perceptual work. I mean, the first shift I would say is not to see a mature tree as a single organism, but as a community. I mean, oak trees support astonishing numbers of species. They are the kind of the host, if you like, or the symbiont of hundreds of insect, bird, and plant epiphyte species. And mature trees, just their slow ecology, as George Monbiot called it recently, and the fact that they are kind of whirled and crannied and holed and rotten and dying in large part makes them astonishingly hospitable to a plurality of life. So I think, you know, I wrote this poem, Spell Heartwood, a protest poem for the people of Sheffield, where the council was felling thousands of trees according to a redacted contract, and seemed set to fell about 15,000 street trees in that city. You know, that spell, which Jackie then brilliantly illustrated, turned into a kind of charm against harm, became very much taken up by tree protesters in that city, sung and chanted, read aloud, hung as a talisman around the trees, and has then spread around the world to other tree protester communities, including in India, where it's been translated into Telugu and other Indian languages. And I just, something about that, I find it feels really cracklingly live to work with that and to give that and to see the way culture can move. That felt a very fortunate thing to be part of. When I read it in the past, I've dedicated it to Disha Ravi, the Indian environmental protester who was imprisoned. This time I dedicate it to the protesters at Fairy Creek on Vancouver Island, where they're trying to prevent the felling of up to 2,000-year-old yellow cedars and some of the last old growth forest on that island. So Heartwood, would you hew me to the heartwood cutter? Would you leave me open-hearted? Put an ear to my bark, hear my saps mutter, mark my heartwood's beat, my leaves flutter. Would you turn me to timber cutter, leave me nothing but a heap of logs, a pile of brash? I am a world cutter. I am a maker of life, drinker of rain, breaker of rocks, caster of shade, eater of sun. I am timekeeper, breath giver, deep thinker. I am a city of butterflies, a country of creatures. But my world takes years to grow and seconds to crash. Your saw can fell me. Your axe can bring me low. Do you hear these words I utter? I ask this, have you, heartwood cutter? Have those who sent you?
That spectacle, Robert, that you mentioned there of young people attempting to preserve 2,000-year-old old growth. I mean, there seems to be almost a concerted attack on anything that belongs to the deep past, any culture, any remnant vegetation. It appears to be the enemy of the modern.
Well, it's really interesting to hear you cast it that starkly, Jonathan. I mean, of course, I've thought about attacks on the old, but I hadn't thought about it almost as a paradigm, as a driving obligation. I mean, I learn a lot of thinking about this very tentatively from your great writer Alexis Wright, with whom I I'm very fortunate to have a friendship and a correspondence. And of course, I've read all of Alexis's books and teach them here and watch what they do to my students, PhD, MPhil, undergraduates. It's astonishing what happens when they meet Alexis's work and her essays. There's one essay where she has this phrase, "Dear broken rivers," and she is speaking of life and of damage, of oldness, of respect, of rights. From that perspective, from her perspective as a land rights activist, as a writer, as a thinker, and so finding and sort of modestly, humbly learning from other traditions, seems very important to me.
Well, and learning from the world itself, is there a language? Is there a language in landscapes? Is the great problem translating that into our own words?
Well, as you mentioned at the beginning, I wrote a book called Landmarks in 2015, which is an attempt to kind of challenge the poverty and the genericization of our language for landscape in these islands, and to look backwards and see this astonishing, supple, inflected, rich word hoard that exists in the many languages, dialects, sub-dialects that are spoken and have been spoken in these islands over the years. So to celebrate a wildflower meadow of languages, possibility of pointing to, subtilizing, naming, celebrating aspects of place and its life, landscape, nature, weather. And I delved into this word hoard and came up over several years, thanks to the generosity of many word givers and word keepers across these islands, with 4,000 to 5,000 words. Runach Muim is one of the ones I often go back to in Gaelic, Hebridean, Lewisian Gaelic of the Western Isles. It means the sun, the shadows cast on moorland by clouds on a sunny, windy day. Literally means mackerel moor. And this was a word that was made, a metaphor that was made by people who worked that landscape. It wasn't a kind of poetic sentimentalization.
You have to think into the culture that created that word image.
Yeah, it was good drying weather. It's good peat drying weather. If you see the mackerel moor, then it's a good time to get the peat stacks drying.
When I first moved to Wales, I met a wonderful poet called Mireret Hopwood, and she said to me that if I listen here, the stones would tell me stories. And that's what I've been spending my time trying to do, to listen to the language of the wind as it moves over the land, the birds and their language, and to try to understand this non-human language. At the moment, the seals have come to shore to pup, and you can hear the mothers talking to their children. And over 6 weeks, you can watch. I think seals have really got it right. They give birth, and 6 weeks later, the child swims off and it's out on its own. Kind of envy them, really.
Good model.
But yeah, fantastic. But the song, we call it song because it sounds like song to our ears, of these mothers talking to their children, is just wonderful.
I remember, Jackie, going there in the mist to the pupping beach with you and standing above it and just hearing these haunting cries drifting up from that inaccessible beach, 200 feet. 100 feet below us, and thinking that that is a small wild world there.
Yeah, and it's my clock these days, the way the world turns. So the wheat ears arrive in the spring, and the curlew will be here soon, and that's kind of how the world turns for me these days.
There's also the holiday makers who turn up in the summer and swear outside your door.
That is a tide that I miss, because they move like the tide, so you can go out when they're not around, other than the ones that you want to see, Robert.
For all those glorious things, though, Robert, and this perhaps a final and potentially somber note to end on, that wonderful natural world of the pupping seals, of the returning curlew, we hope, And yet what we have done to that is itself an inherently natural phenomenon. We are of this place too. The Anthropocene is a natural occurrence. What unpick that paradox for me.
It's really hard because I think the heresy of aloofness, which we might call it, the delusion that we are separate, we are non-natural, has led to so much of this. But the flat ontology, if you like, that arises when we collapse all entities, all organisms into nature, and say, well, everything's natural. The Anthropocene is natural. Well, that flat ontology leaves us unable to construct systems of value for moving forwards, for what is good, for what to fight for, what to keep. And so I'm wary of both the heresy of aloofness and the collapse into a flat ontology. I think I go back to the summum bonum, the true good of diversity. Diversity of life is what epigenetically, evolutionarily, has given rise to wonder, has given rise to this astonishing biome that we inherited and that we are currently plundering. So for me, whenever I'm asking a question about what is good, what is worthwhile, I guess I go back to the notion of that diverse life in all its wondrous forms is the great generative force in the world, and that we should work to preserve that rather than to destroy it.
I'm grateful for that resolving note of what in fact turned out to be a positivity, and fabulous to talk to you both and to hear that natural world ringing in both your voices, both your descriptions.
Thank you.
Robert McFarlane and Jackie Morris, the creative team behind those magnificent works, The Lost Words and The Lost Spells, chatting with me, Jonathan Green, as part of RN's Big Weekend of Books.